It is 8:08 in the morning, and you are listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert. The breaking news out of the Supreme Court this morning is a decision that went very badly for organized labor in the United States. The case was Janus versus AFSCME, AFSCME being the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And it was a test of something that had been settled law since the 1970s, which was the ability of unions in the public sector to collect from their members fees sufficient, to collect from people who are represented by that union but choose not to become members, fees that are sufficient to pay for the cost of representation for services like collectively bargaining a contract and representing those workers in arbitration disputes. The decision went against organized labor. That means unions representing some 5 million public employees in this country may have a significant blow to their pocketbooks. That also has political ramifications because many of those unions are the only significant institutional counterforces to Republican donor-backed organizations in state, local, and federal politics. Although the money in question was not the money that they would use to pay for political work, weakening those institutions overall does change the balance of power. We have a whole panel of guests lined up to speak about this morning. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking to Bill Gould. He is the former chair of the National Labor Relations. Now, right now, joining us by Skype, Stephen Pitts, associate chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. Good morning, Steve. Steve Pitts, can you hear us?
Oh, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Let's talk big picture here before we get into the legal weeds. What's the impact going to be?
Well, you know, you're saying that in your intro, this is a blow to unions. It's really a blow to working people overall. That study has shown that it's not just a matter of union members benefiting from the presence of unions, but most working people do benefit. We've, at the Labor Center, we've put out some reports in the last month or so, but details in California how a wide range of public policies that benefit most people in California can be attributed to the support the unions have provided. And so the benefits of unions go way beyond the members themselves. And so, as you said, the ruling will hurt unions very directly, but it'll also hurt working people throughout the state and throughout the nation.
I want to bring into the conversation William Gould. He's a professor of law emeritus at Stanford University. He served as chair of the National Labor Relations Board under the Obama administration. Bill Gould, thank you for joining us.
Very good to be with you. It was in the Clinton administration, however.
Excuse me. Still early in the morning for me.
Sure.
Can we talk about the underlying question of law here? This is a case of the Supreme Court actually overturning a prior decision by the Supreme Court. This is the Abood case. What did that hold? What are the consequences of changing it?
Well, the Abood case held that a union may negotiate voluntarily with the public employer an agreement providing that everyone pays their fair share for the cost of union representation, resolving grievances and engaging in collective bargaining. Since the union has been selected by a majority of the employees. At the same time, those who objected to that portion of the dues, if any, which were used for political purposes, could object and have a rebate for those monies because of the First Amendment concerns, the right of free speech.
So this was a very hair-splitty decision, because it tried to distinguish between money unions collected from workers for political purposes and money that it collected for more transactional representational purposes. It seems like that's what kind of opened up the wiggle room for this new round of litigation. There's an argument that everything a union does is political, right?
Well, that's true. But I think what really opened up this wiggle room was the fact that new appointees to the Supreme Court, particularly Justice Alito, who has authored again this morning's opinion, and he's authored a number of them leading up to this, were deeply dissatisfied with not only this arrangement, but with the idea of unions themselves. It's very interesting. In this morning's opinion, Alito has a passage where he says that the founding fathers of the Constitution would be shocked by the idea of public sector unions and these kinds of agreements. It just would run against everything that they were promoting. And that's the essence of the holding, that unions weren't around in 1787, and the founding fathers therefore would be shocked by what has evolved over this period.
So this specifically applies to unions in the public sector. Does the legal reasoning open up a line of attack on union rights in the private sector?
Well, there could be an attack on the private sector with unions, which will result from this. One of the things that Alito has always been concerned about in these cases where he's written opinions leading to today has been the fact that the objectors had the burden was upon them to object. He had always questioned that. I don't know. I haven't, you know, there are 88 pages here, and I'm I haven't read every word of Alito's this morning yet. So I don't know what he says about that, about that presumption. That kind of the reasoning of Abood and earlier cases that preceded Abood in the involving the Railway Labor Act had assumed that the burden was upon the objector, since after all the union is the majority representative selected by the majority. The concept of collective bargaining in the United States has been, and throughout much of the world, has been that it is a representative system, that we elect people to represent us and to support what we think are our best interests. In Alito's opinion, what comes across time and time again is that the individual is being suppressed by the idea of government, self-government, in the collective bargaining process. It's a proposition that would never hold water. For instance, in terms of our own representative system, where I have to pay my taxes towards a war that I don't approve of, or through many public policies that I don't approve of, because, as is the case with collective bargaining, the system is built upon majority rule, and we'll have chaos if each individual can decide what he or she wants to do.
Brian, one thing I wanted to interject real briefly.
Please.
A couple of things, actually. It's important for listeners to understand that the way the law reads, that when a union is in a workplace situation, they must represent all workers who are members or who maybe not be members. And so the issue is really a matter of are people allowed to ride for free, you might say.
And when you say because must, it's a statutory obligation.
Correct. And so the issue simply is, do people who do not belong to a union, should they pay for the representation that they get? That's very important for listeners to understand that. The second important thing, I think you raised the question of, will it be some sort of transmission from the public sector to the private sector? I think the process is the reverse. In essence, what we have in the private sector is right-to-work laws. And what the decision does today is simply bringing that into the public sector, where people can simply be in a workplace, be covered by a collective bargaining agreement, but not have to pay for the service they receive because of that.
Well, Stephen Pitts, that was going to be my question to you, is what are the lessons from the states that have passed right-to-work laws? How have they impacted unions in the public sector, and what change in organizing strategy, private sector rather, what change in organizing strategy has it required? Stephen Pitts.
Bill wants to say something. He can speak.
I don't know. I guess it's aimed at you, but I do want to say simply that the right-to-work laws, of course, are different. This is what the Supreme Court has done this morning is promulgate a national right-to-work law for the entire public sector. I think that's the important point. But the other is that those are done legislatively. This is a court that has always preached the virtue its members have in past days of judicial restraint. But this is an activist court which has come in and decided for the people the kind of labor relations system we're going to have. And we've seen what right-to-work laws have done in a number of the states. Recently, states that had relatively good wages and benefits, Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, in all of these states, there has been both a drop in union membership and also a drop in comparative conditions and wages. So scholars who have looked at counties that adjoin one another in both right-to-work states and non-right-to-work states have seen that in right-to-work states where collective bargaining is able to function more effectively because everybody pays their fair share, all workers do better.
But one thing, I guess, in answer to your question, Brian, you raised also, that we've seen in right-to-work states, we've seen now an upsurge in union activism. I mean, we've seen that in terms of some of the activity around teachers and trying to advance their interests. We've also seen that in advance of this decision, that many unions have increased their outreach to their members in an attempt to kind of forestall what they thought would happen as a result of this decision. And so we talk about studies showing the impact of the change in the legal context for unionization. What we've seen in response to that has been an increase in activism on the part of unions and union members to forestall those things.
Right, but on balance, how does it come out? I mean, I was thinking legally, this is basically a return to the status quo before states started passing laws that enabled collective bargaining in the public sector.
Absolutely.
This was partially a period in which workers worked under worse circumstances, but it was also a period in which there was more militant union activity. How do you think it comes out in the wash?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, everything that comes out in the wash is second best. There are ways, there are things that unions can do, and there has been, as being pointed out, a rise in militancy, a rise in an attempt to fight back by some unions. But it's all second best once we deprive unions in this country of the ability to act as any government would be able to do in the public sphere, and that is to call upon those who have chosen it to pay, all of them, to pay their fair share, even those, that minority who have not chosen by voting against the union to pay their fair share as well.
I mean, if the question is the ruling good or bad for working people, it's bad. But it doesn't mean the end of unions, nor the end of worker organizations. And what it does provide is simply a new context for the struggle. And I'm not trying to be rhetorical in a sense of jargonistic, but that's the reality. Because Brian, you mentioned the fact that we had a point in time in this country's history, we had a very unfavorable terrain for working people that existed, and it changed. And so if today marks a return to those unfavorable times, then we can say, well, eventually we'll have returned to the better times as well. It's simply a new context. And not at all trying to make light of the decision at all, but it's simply a new context for struggle. And we've seen that recently.
I mean, in many ways, labor law is a trade-off because the compromise represented by labor law that creates collective bargaining rights also imposes some amount of discipline, some amount of restrictions on what unions can do. It puts some tactics off the board as unfair labor practices in the private sector and their equivalent in the public sector. It was a response to an era in which there were many more militant strikes, sit-down strikes, often violent clashes between strikers, strike breakers, and private security forces. The way to read that is kind of a compromise between capital and labor and the sake of having a more orderly economy. I guess my question is that era of militancy gone, or absent the legal framework that had restrained it, is that the kind of era we might be heading back into?
But Brian, laws are always compromises. And so you may have a period of fierce struggle between labor and capital. The result will always be a law to regulate that. The question is the nature of the law. So the problem isn't the law itself, it's the context that gives rise to the law. And I think that's important because some people may hear what you say and imply that it's better not to have the law itself. And because then we have some sort of fierce, you know, general strike happening every day. And the reality is that if we did have daily general strikes, well, the result would be some new law. So the question isn't the law itself. It's how we come to the law and the nature of the law that emerges.
Bill Gould, what other cases regarding collective bargaining rights are waiting in the wings for this Supreme Court? Is Janus going to be the final word?
Well, yeah, Janus, there's no such thing in the law as the final word. Janus, there will be other cases that will emerge as a result of reactions to Janus. Of course, there are no cases involving other issues that I'm aware of that are now pending before the Supreme Court, thank goodness, because the Supreme Court is hell-bent on destroying the collective bargaining process. But, we've been thinking, and a lot of us have been thinking for some time, how do we live in the new world of post-Janus? Because, of course, this decision is hardly a surprise. We've all been anticipating it for months, if not years. One thing that has been suggested is that by Alito's opinion itself is that the unions could charge a service fee if a non-union member wanted to go through the grievance process. The difficulty and therefore avoid this free rider problem, which is the heart of the problem in involving these so-called agency fee agreements. The problem has always been that what's been litigated for years is in essence that the collective bargaining and the grievance process, in particular, grievance arbitration process, is a kind of insurance system. None of us think that that the day is ever going to come when some bad person is going to exclude us provide for our dismissal or demote one of us. But then that day comes, and because you're paid into the system, you get the insurance benefit. Now, what's going to happen, of course, here, as a result of what Alito has suggested, is that you're going to have a large number of non-union members who are not paying into the system, but that are going to say, for whatever reason, hey, that bad day has arrived. The boss has done something bad to me. Represent me. And Alito is saying, in what we call dicta, it's not part of the holding, but it's language he used. He says this is something unions can do. Then the question arises, well, what can the union charge? What would you charge if you went to the hospital and are not part of the insurance scheme that the hospital has?
Well, it seems to me there's an even bigger question. The unions can do that. They can charge fee per service. But do they want to do that? It would seem to be a tactic that runs contrary to the attempt to build a unified collective entity of workers.
You're going to another issue here, and that is that, and I've mentioned this in speeches that I've given to union audiences, there are cases now in the courts, not before the Supreme Court, where unions are saying, hey, listen, if these non-union people cannot be compelled to be part of us, we're not compelled to be part of them, because what gives rise to the obligation to process the grievance is the exclusive bargaining representative system. Now, the exclusive bargaining representative system contains both strengths and weaknesses. The strength is that the union is able to speak for everyone, but the weakness is that the union has to be careful what it does with regard to those who either it may be hostile to, or people may think they're hostile to, and the duty of fair representation has always been part of this exclusive system. Now we have cases that have arisen in the Midwest where unions are saying, okay, constitutionally there can be no duty of fair representation system now because we can't represent everybody as a matter of law. And that's the kind of that's one of the many avenues that unions are going to be looking at as the story unfolds. I happen to think that these cases would not make sense for the labor movement because I think that employers who are hostile to unions will be able to play one group off against one another in the absence of an exclusive system.
Bill's point's really important, because I think this issue is not so much a financial issue or a legal issue, it's an organizing issue. And so the question of a tactic that unions take up to go forward in this new context is a matter of what can they do to best organize the people in the workplace itself. And to hope very much that unions look at this to be an organizing situation and not trying to find some sort of fix to bring in more money. Because that sort of approach will sort of doom them to more and more failure.
Stephen Pitts, final question. I know this specifically does not concern the money that unions use to engage in politics, but they are major political players, particularly in states like California. I'm thinking of our last major tax hike, largely bankrolled the ballot box fight by teachers' unions. The nurses' unions have been behind ballot box fights to raise staffing standards in the healthcare sector. Any number of progressive initiatives in state politics, it's hard to imagine happening without significant backing from public sector unions. Does this have a significant impact on that side of the operation?
Oh, it does. I mean, I couldn't give the details, but it has to, because, Brian, before you had two pots of money to do many things, and now you're going to lose one pot of money. And so the money they had come in, they still have come in, that's to cover all that was done before. And so there's less money to spread around, and less money to put into initiatives that benefit all Californians. So we'll have a short-term, maybe a medium-term, devastating impact.
All right. That's the voice of Stephen Pitts. He's Associate Chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. With us on the phone, William Gould, Professor of Law Emeritus at Stanford University, former Chair of the National Labor Relations Board. Thank you, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye, Brian.
We had also been hoping to speak with Jane McAlevey, who is a veteran organizer and now labor scholar, but the clock ran out before we were able to complete the connection. We will try to continue this conversation in the days to come, because it is a day of reckoning for organized labor, and try to bring her back in then. Right now it is 8:30 in the morning. The program's Up Front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert.